A renowned deep sea explorer is on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Marine biologist and oceanographer Edith Witter has a quote pinned to her bulletin board. It says this: "The world will not perish for want of wonders, but for want of wonder." And her wonder has taken her to dangerous depths. She has made hundreds of deep sea dives in research submersibles, these vessels designed to dive to much deeper depths than submarines can. What do you want to know about exploring deep oceans or about the first images of a giant squid? 800-642-1234. Edith Witter is co-founder, CEO, and a senior scientist at the Ocean Research and Conservation Association, working to preserve and protect the oceans. Her new book is called Below the Edge of Darkness, a memoir exploring light and life in the deep sea. Edie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So before you take us below the surface, can you acquaint us with your tools of the trade? Because this will help us visualize how you get down there. What is it like to be in a submersible vessel, that single-person deep rover?
So that first submersible, that was a single person, as you say, and it looks like a little helicopter. It's got a bubble, and it sits on a base that holds thrusters, and so you can fly it around. I equate it to probably the best video game you can ever imagine. You can spin it around and it zips around the bottom or in the midwater. It's a fantastic tool. Nowadays, there are some pretty impressive submersibles coming on the market, three-person, multi-person submersibles, so you don't have to be the pilot. Same kind of design, though. You're sitting in a plexiglass bubble, so it's sort of like goldfish in a goldfish bowl, only the fish are on the outside and you're on the inside.
Do you ever get the feeling of, oh my gosh, get me out of here, or just feeling so enclosed, claustrophobic?
Because it's a transparent bubble, in those submersibles, I've never had a sense of claustrophobia. I did once in a diving suit, which was actually my first experience of diving in the deep ocean. It was a metal suit called the WASP, not because that's an acronym, but just somebody thought it looked like the insect with
that
a big yellow
big
body.
Yellow, right, yeah.
And a bulbous head and pincers for arms. No legs, it's just flies around with thrusters. And my first dive in it was spectacular because I turned out the lights and saw bioluminescence, and it changed the course of my career. My second dive was deeper. The first one was to 800 feet. The second one, I went to 1,800 and I think it was 83 or 82 feet. And on the way down, I kept hearing this popping noise that started to make me a little nervous. And because it's on a tether, I could talk to the surface very easily. So I was talking to the controller and he said, oh, he thought it was probably the syntactic foam, which is the flotation that they use on that suit. And that's on the outside, so not to worry. But it was making me a little jumpy. And then I got down to 1,883 feet, whatever it was. And he called down to say, congratulations, you just broke the world depth record in the WASP. Yeah. I said, what the hell do you mean? I thought this thing was rated to 2,000 feet. He said, yeah, but nobody's ever been. And I suddenly had a very, very clear image of how much water was over my head. And the suit gave that the loudest pop yet. And I wanted out of there so fast. I just had this very immediate claustrophobic response, the sweats, the shakes, everything. But I managed to just refocus. There was a jellyfish just outside the suit that was doing something really fascinating. And I just focused all my attention on that and managed to get control of the fear factor.
What about the pressure at those depths? How do these vessels deal with that?
Well, at that depth, if I'd sprung a leak, it would have been such that it would have cut through my flesh like a knife through butter. That's the amazing thing about these submersibles and diving suits. You're at atmospheric pressure inside the suit. They have to be made of really dense material to make sure that that doesn't happen. But it means that you don't have to decompress. You come up from a dive and you just go have dinner with everybody else.
Yeah. You've piloted a submersible vessel thousands of feet below, but it started to leak. What went on there?
Yeah, that was a very unpleasant experience. The controller on that dive wasn't as good as the one on the WASP dives, and he actually had left a valve open and didn't tell me. Not only had he left it open, but he'd taken the handle off. And so as I was diving, I kept hearing this noise that I never heard before. It was kind of a high-pitched whine, and I kept trying to move around to see if I could hear where it was coming from. It seemed to be coming from the starboard side on the right-hand side. And I was bending over almost at the waist to try to get my ear closer to where the sound seemed to be coming from. And my stocking feet, which were propped up on the plexiglass sphere in front of me, slid down into seawater. And I mean, the terror was incredible. And I looked down and I could see immediately where the water was coming in, but there was no way to get it stopped. And so there was that moment of wondering, had I already passed the point of no return? Because the water coming in was making the sub heavier. And there becomes a point when it's so heavy that no amount of your ballasting up is going to get you out of that situation. It's a positive feedback loop. And so there was a very tense few moments as I blew ballast and jammed on my vertical thrusters and just waited to see what was going to happen.
Mm. Edie Witter, she's an oceanographer and author of Below the Edge of Darkness. You can join in. What questions do you have about bioluminescence or what it's like in deep oceans and how you get there? 800-642-1234. John is joining us from Madison. Hi, John. Hi, John. Can you hear us? You're a technical diver, I understand. Oh, and we're having trouble hearing John, who is absolutely fascinated by you being in a submersible. What is the evolution of that technology? Can you explain how far we've come?
So the WASP was a diving suit that was developed by the offshore oil industry for diving on oil rigs down to depths of 2,000 feet. And, you know, we were just at the right in the 80s there when I started diving, was just when the Deep Rover was developed. But prior to that, the Johnson Sea Lynx were really the pioneers in developing these plexiglass sphere type systems that gave you this just absolutely breathtaking view of the deep ocean. But it's been a fairly recent development to have this kind of capability to go into the deep ocean. And now it's changing in pretty exciting ways because of new developments in material science and submersible engineering. And so you're seeing submersibles that are now available for $1 million or $2 million, which really isn't much when you're talking about a tool for exploration. And so these are things that wealthy people are buying to have on their yachts now.
You have encountered really unusual creatures in the deep sea, and many of these animals produce their own light, and we may never witness this in person. Can you just describe what that's like to us?
The word people use most often when they see it is magical, and it really is. My first dive in WASP, when I went down to 800 feet, it was an evening dive, and I turned out the lights. And I was surrounded by what I could only think of as like a fireworks display. And when I came up from that dive, I was asked, you know, what's it like down there? And I blurted out, it's like the 4th of July. And I took a lot of ribbing from my colleagues because that was a pretty unscientific thing to say. But I've lost track of the number of times I've heard people describe it like that. Only it's so much better because it's not at a distance. You're in the middle of the fireworks display. In fact, you're causing it because your every movement is stimulating these sprays of blue sparks and swirls of what looks like glowing smoke, just swirling all around you. It looks like Vincent van Gogh's Starry Night.
Hmm. And it comes in all colors, the bioluminescence, red and orange, yellow, green. But in the open ocean, it's blue that dominates. Why is that?
Well, if you've ever opened your eyes underwater, everything looks blue, right? That's because that's the color that travels furthest through seawater. And so animals have evolved the color that's going to be most effective in communication and penetrate furthest through seawater.
We have marine biologist and oceanographer Edie Witter, who has spent four decades studying bioluminescence and explaining how we need to learn so much more about our oceans to care for them. What are you curious about with the largest ecosystem on the planet, a world teeming with light makers, as Edie puts it? Have you ever been diving and saw creatures in the sea creating their own light? What was that like? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Edie Witter here on the Ideas Network. How thrilling to have deep sea explorer Edie Witter on the morning show. I'm Kedar Chirkent. Edie calls the ocean a fantastically strange and wonderful place. She's on a quest to study the ocean's creatures and encounters with bioluminescence, the ability for organisms to create light. Have you ever been diving and saw creatures in the sea creating their own light? What was that like? Are you worried about threats to ocean life like plastic and trash, toxins? What can be done? Join in 800-642-1234. Edie co-founded the Ocean Research and Conservation Association, or ORCA, taking on these difficult challenges, and she's with us for the hour. Edie, we heard from Heather, called from Madison, couldn't stay with us, and Heather says that fireflies use bioluminescence that's similar to what you see underwater with these deep sea fish that produce light. And Heather is a diver and says that they used to describe people about what it's like underwater, so people on land are getting a taste of what it's like without realizing it, and was wondering what you can say there about bioluminescence.
So that's absolutely right. The type of bioluminescence most people are familiar with are fireflies, and there are some other land animals that can make light. There's some earthworms and millipedes, centipedes. There's actually some fungi. But in general, on land, it's quite rare. And so people, I think, generally assume the same thing is true in the ocean, but nothing could be further from the truth. Most of the animals in the open ocean make light. And there are places where it's anywhere from 75% to 90% of the animals in the ocean make light. And they use it to help them survive, to find food, to attract mates, to defend against predators. Firefly bioluminescence is one kind of chemistry, but there's different types of chemistries. The animals make light by mixing chemicals together. The chemicals are called luciferin and luciferase, but they actually are different chemicals, different types of luciferins and different types of luciferases in different animals, which is an indication of how valuable light making is to these animals, that it has evolved multiple different times.
The fish, they have this basic need for food and survival. And you have this wonderful analogy of being in a pitch black superdome. Can you describe that feeling or what the fish are encountering?
So one of the things I discovered diving in submersibles was that the bioluminescence generally needs to be stimulated for you to see it. If I would go down in deep rover and trim out to neutral buoyancy, so I was just dead in the water, then it was dark. I sat there waiting to count the number of flashes per minute, but there was nothing. But as soon as I moved or bumped the thrusters on the submersible, I was just surrounded by explosions of light. And so that means that the deep sea is this minefield. And so I use the analogy of being in the Superdome and it's pitch black and there are yummy apples dangling from strings, if you can only find them, to keep yourself from starving to death. Trouble is, there's also little lights dangling from strings that only light up when you bump into them. And in the Superdome there with you is a black panther, also hungry. And so as long as you don't move, you're safe. But at some point, you're going to get so hungry, you're going to have to go in search of those apples. And as soon as you bump into one of those lights, you're going to be aware of that panther's head's snapping around and gaining focus on you. So what can you possibly do to defend yourself against that? Well, one thing that animals do is they can actually eject their bioluminescent chemicals, just the way a squid or an octopus will eject an ink cloud. These critters can spew out their luciferin and luciferase into the face of a predator and swim away in the darkness. There's shrimp that do this. There's actually fish that do it. There's a lot of squid that do it. It's a really common trick.
Let's try John and Madison again. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. What a great topic. It's really exciting to hear about this morning. I've been a deep water technical diver for about 30 years. I've only been to depths a little over 400 feet, which is deep for a diver. I have to pay for my dives with long decompressions, but I've never had the opportunity to be in a submersible. I always wanted to do it, but it's great to hear these descriptions because even at the shallower depths I go to, there's just so many wonderful things that I get to see and experience. It's just great to hear this, and thanks for having this guest on today.
John, what have you seen in your dives? What has been one of the more amazing moments?
Most of my diving is done in shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, so I get to go back in these old shipwrecks and go inside and see these time capsules from 50 or 100 plus years ago, untouched from the day they sank, and also in caves, going into caves and seeing just these unworldly environments that are nothing like anything you see on the surface.
John, thank you. Edie, it's a whole new world under there.
I'm in awe of his technical diving in caves to 400 feet. Oh my goodness. He's clearly a very talented diver.
That is absolutely amazing. And how are you able to photograph, when you see these flashes or take video under there in these conditions?
So I actually did get the first video ever recorded of bioluminescence, and I did it with an intensified video camera that was black and white. And then we colorized the image so people could see what the luminescence looked like. But that was back in the 80s, as I said. Now we've got cameras coming online that are as good and even slightly better than the fully dark adapted human eye. And so we're starting to see more and more imagery of bioluminescence. And I hope it's going to awake people to just this absolutely exquisite phenomenon that is a natural part of our planet, a pretty common part of our planet that most people don't get to see. It would be so wonderful, I think, if we ended up having a deep sea tourist industry, just the way they were talking about a deep space tourist industry.
Well, let's go to Bob now in Madison on jellyfish. Bob, hi.
Hi. I have seen bioluminescence, you know, in waves and in the wakes of boats and in bio bays, but you've described these creatures at such great depths, and they seem so soft. And you described how if your suit were to leak or your vessel would leak, you would be crushed. How do these creatures survive at these great depths and not be crushed? I know that might be a crazy question.
It's not a crazy question. It's a smart question. The thing is that those creatures don't have any air-filled spaces in their bodies the way we do. So they're just water, surrounded by water. So it's completely comfortable for them. It's, creatures like us that have lungs and sinuses that are at risk when we go at depth, fish with air bladders. There are deep-sea fish that have swim bladders. But if you bring them up slowly enough, they can adjust the gas pressures such that they don't explode. If you bring them up fast, then they explode. So it's all about the air spaces.
Help us understand this edge of darkness, that, fish swimming toward darkness in order to hide. Their eyes can detect sunlight at depths in excess of 3,000 feet?
Correct. Yeah, even deeper than our own eyes can. They sacrifice resolution to be able to have that kind of sensitivity. But if you imagine as animals were evolving in the ocean, a big jump forward was with the evolution of eyes and the be able to detect prey at a distance. So the problem for prey in the open ocean environment is there's no place to hide. There's no trees or bushes or hidey holes. And so the only way for animals to avoid being eaten was either to evolve to be faster swimmers than their predators, or to find a place to hide, which was to go down deep. And so they would go down below the edge of darkness during the day, and then follow that edge of darkness up to the surface at night, where photosynthesis occurs, in order to eat. And so that's resulted in the most massive animal migration pattern on the planet, where animals travel down in just staggering numbers every single day in oceans all around the world to hide in the dark depths during the day and then come up and eat in surface waters at night. And so they spend most of their lives in near darkness, below the edge of darkness, which is why so many of them have evolved this capability of making light.
Yeah, the city's rush hour there as we talk with marine biologist Edie Witter. We'll pick it up with her after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We have a deep sea explorer on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Marine biologist Edie Witter became a giant squid hunter after a TED Talk she delivered over a decade ago now. And she writes how seeing a giant squid in the wild became the holy grail of natural history cinematography. Edie invented a camera system, an electronic jellyfish that can attract giant predators of the sea. What are your questions for this scientist? Are you worried about climate change's effects on our watery planet? Join in 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. The memoir is called Below the Edge of Darkness, and Edie Witter is with us for the hour. Edie, let's talk about giant squid in the ocean, your camera capturing the first footage in U.S. waters. Why has this animal been so difficult to observe?
Well, that's a very good question, because it turns out that they're actually reasonably common. It's not like they're rare. And we know they're common because of the number of giant squid beaks that have been found in sperm whale stomachs. Hmm. So if there's potentially millions of them out there, why aren't we seeing them? Well, giant squid have the largest eye of any animal we know of. It's the size of a human head. It's enormous. And we go down there with our exploration platforms, submersibles and remote operated vehicles, with these incredibly bright white lights, plus noisy thrusters. How many animals are we scaring away? I mean, giant squid we knew about because they happen to float when they die because they have ammonia in their tissues. What about the stuff that doesn't float? There may be all kinds of creatures down there that we don't know about just because our methods of exploration have been scaring them away.
How were you able to capture footage?
So all those dives that I made in submersibles, I would sit there in the dark with the lights on often, and think about, you know, how many animals are there out there just beyond the reach of my lights that I can't see, but they can see me. And I wanted to develop a camera system that I could leave on the bottom of the ocean that would be unobtrusive. So I wanted to use light that would allow me to see the animals, but they wouldn't see the light, which we do on land all the time. For nocturnal animals, we use infrared lights and infrared cameras, and that works great. But you can't do that in the ocean because infrared light is absorbed so completely by seawater. And even red light is difficult, but I wanted to compensate for that by using an intensified camera like those that I've been using for bioluminescence. And I also wanted to not just put bait in front of that camera. I wanted to attract more than just scavengers. I wanted to attract active predators. So I wanted to develop an electronic jellyfish that imitated a display that I thought might be attractive to large predators. So I had this idea for quite a while, but I had a really tough time getting it funded because the funding agencies would all say, yeah, but what will you discover? And I kept saying, well, that's the point. I don't know, but we need to find out. And so I finally got it put together with a bunch of different sources of funding. Harvey Mudd Engineering Clinic put together the pieces for me, and I got NOAA to put it in an underwater housing and a frame and pay for some early tests. And I got the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, where I was an adjunct, or still am an adjunct, to provide the batteries and the early tests of the system. And I got this kind of kludged together system that we called the Eye in the Sea. And the first time we tested it was in the Gulf of Mexico in 2004. I put it down at an oasis, a place where I thought a lot of large predators might come through. And it wasn't until we got it back that I could review the video and see what we got. And sure enough, I could see the fish swimming around and they were unperturbed by my lights, which was fascinating and fantastic. And then 4 hours into the deployment, I had programmed the electronic jellyfish to come on for the very first time. And 86 seconds after it came on, we recorded a squid over 6 feet long that was completely new to science, couldn't be placed in any known scientific family.
Wow. Wow.
So I went back to the funding agencies and said, this is what we will discover, and got funding to create the world's first deep sea webcam, which was installed in Monterey Canyon. So we had a moored version of the Eye in the Sea. And then you mentioned the TED Talk I gave. I showed some of that video in that TED Talk. There was a giant squid hunter that was part of that TED program, Mike Degree, and he just got incredibly excited when he saw the results where I was showing squid attacking this electronic jellyfish. And he said, do you think this would work for giant squid? And I said, yeah, could be. I mean, they're visual predators. They've got to be with eyes that size. And so it was Mike that got me invited on this television-funded expedition off Japan to go hunt for the giant squid.
That is just fascinating too. And, you know, just bringing up the footage, I know you talked about when you have to wait and let this footage download and then figure out what you have.
Right. It's not in real time.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So what have you been able to learn about giant squid from capturing it on video?
Well, one of the contentious things amongst giant squid aficionados was, you know, whether or not they were sit and wait predators or active visual predators. I thought with eyes like that, they had to be active visual predators. But there were some that really believed that to conserve energy, they just sat and waited for something to swim by. So our recordings have clearly shown that they are active visual predators. They hunt. And also, you know, they've been portrayed as monsters. Just because of their enormous size, they can grow to over, you know, as tall as a four-story building when they've got their tentacles fully extended. So that plus Jules Verne's version of a battle between a human and a giant squid has left people with an impression of them as monsters. But really, looking at the videos that I've recorded, I think they're just shy and curious.
You read about the cockeyed squid. Its name is derived from its mismatched eyes. What can you kind of explain it to us?
So it's got this enormous bulbous eye, which oddly looks up, and a tiny eye that looks down. And that seems confusing because if you need the big eye for where there's not much light and looking up, you're looking towards the light. But what you've got to understand is that it's looking up at the dim, dim, dim gray background of downwelling light to look for a silhouette of something it can eat. And looking down with that little eye is surrounded by built-in headlights in the form of bioluminescent light organs that illuminate prey at a closer range in the darkness. So you really have to understand the light distribution in the ocean to understand some of these very, very strange adaptations that we found.
You have done these experiments, lots of experiments carried out, and what these flashes mean and what is the communication with prey, and, you know, whether it's a burglar alarm hypothesis versus a toxic warning hypothesis, what do these flashes mean?
So yes, some of them are just a warning. Don't eat me or you'll be sorry. There's one jellyfish that produces a green luminescence from its sub-umbrella. Just you'd think it would be a circle, but when you bump it, it turns into a square. And you don't see squares in the deep ocean. And I envision it as almost looking like a skull and crossbones in that environment. So, you know, don't eat me or you'll be sorry. There's some animals, their luminescence rubs off onto their predators. And so it's like the paint packets that banks use, because if you eat this animal, you're going to make yourself into a target. The burglar alarm is actually a scream for help. So if an animal attacks you, you can use every light organ you've got to light up and reveal that attacker to larger animals that may attack your attacker and afford you an opportunity for escape. And then there's a lot of uses of bioluminescence to attract mates. Hmm. So some animals have very specific shaped light organs that are, you know, species specific. Some of them have specific flash patterns. One of the lovely stories is sea fireflies, which are so named because it is very much like the firefly use of bioluminescence to attract a mate. Only these little guys are ostracods. They're crustaceans about the size of sesame seeds. And they swim out just after sunset and squirt out a little dab of luciferin and luciferase in a blob of mucus and then swim up in another blob and another blob. And you get this string of dots, glowing dots in the water. And the spacing of the dots is species specific. So a female knows if she goes to the head of that particular spacing of dots, she can find a male to mate with.
Wow. The males that are putting on the show.
The males are putting on the show. Yep.
Wow. We're talking with Edie Witter, who's author of Below the Edge of Darkness. It's a memoir exploring light and life in the deep sea. Taking your questions at 800-642-1234. You know, you would also use a trawl bucket to gather up all these animals and bring them up with these giant nets to study bioluminescence. What have you discovered there?
So I worked with a scientist named Jim Childress, who developed a way to bring the animals up alive. A lot of people think that when you bring animals up to the surface, they die because of the pressure difference. And certainly that can be a problem for some animals. But the much greater problem is temperature, because the deep sea is quite cold and you bring them up through surface waters, they're cooked alive. So with his net, there was a closing cod end at the end that kept the animals cold. So we'd bring them up and we could bring them up alive. And that was actually my first experience seeing bioluminescence, was in Jim Childress's trawl bucket, because those animals were squirting luminescence or flashing luminescence, and it was really spectacular. And so having them alive allowed us to measure their light output, you know, learn about all the different colors, how they use their different colors. There was a deep sea fish called a stoplight fish that was collected in that way that... I discovered its red light. Well, it has both blue and red light organs, and the blue are high beams, but the red, it can use for a private communications channel, because most animals in the ocean only see blue light, but the stoplight fish can also see both blue and red light. Hmm. And so it can use the red light like a sniper scope to sneak up on animals that can't see red light and attack them, or it can use it as a private wave band to talk to a mate. And not risk attracting their own predators, because it's not a color that any other animal can see. And I measured that light output and discovered that it had a very interesting filter in front of it. And I actually copied that filter in order to get the illumination system for the eye and the sea just right.
Marine biologist Edie Witter with us, taking us to her science, to the work of being thousands of feet beneath the surface of the ocean. What questions do you have about creatures and bioluminescence? What have you wondered about when organizing dives at this depth? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Edie Witter here in the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Deep sea explorer Edie Witter concludes in her memoir that we will venture into the deep ocean because that's what humans do. We explore. New deep diving technologies are being developed even as government funding for ocean exploration has continued to shrink. Edie has made hundreds of deep sea dives in research submersibles, and she stays with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's go to Peg now in Cedarburg. Hi, Peg. What is your experience?
Well, thanks for the show. It's really interesting. I was with my family in St. Croix several years ago, and we went on an evening kayak. And when we got into the water, if anyone dipped into the water, these bioluminescent creatures would, you know, surround our bodies, and it would light up our bodies in the water. We were just stunned and overwhelmed by the beauty of it. And I'm wondering why they were attracted to our bodies. Is it because we were warm or whatever? But it was just an amazing experience and very magical. Mm. I'll take my answer off the air.
Peg, thanks. Edie?
Well, my guess is that it probably was sea fireflies. They used to be extremely common in the Caribbean, and they still are in places that aren't polluted. You can get dense aggregations of them because it's a mating display. You know, they're often grouped together. It depends on the species, but I suspect that that's what it was.
Amazing. You know, I want to talk a little bit about sight. And when you were in college in the late 60s, early 70s, you had a surgery that left you temporarily blind. You had very scary edge-of-death health setbacks. What did this experience teach you about sight?
Well, it made me fascinated by the whole concept of vision and light. And I think it predisposed me to my later fascination with bioluminescence because I think maybe it helped me think about what it must be like for these animals living in darkness most of the time with just, you know, occasional flashes of light, because that's a little what it was like for me for a while as I was regaining my vision. And so it just made me think about the aspects of sight and communication a lot more.
Mm. What threats are ocean environments facing?
Well, unfortunately, a lot of threats. I mean, we've got carbon dioxide, as we know, impacting climate change, but it's dissolving in seawater. And when it does, it produces carbonic acid. So we're acidifying the ocean, which it's just staggering that we could be changing the chemistry of such an enormous volume. We're talking about 300 million cubic miles of water, and we've changed its chemistry. And it's valiantly been trying to keep up with the heat that is building up in the environment, because greenhouse gases are not letting heat escape the way it used to from the surface of the earth. And so the temperature of the ocean is changing. And one of the things that's happening is the rivers in the ocean, like the Gulf Stream, are being impacted by that. They move heat around the planet, and they've helped maintain a stable environment for us for long enough that, you know, we've got very advanced agriculture. But before we had those rivers in the ocean and the stability of temperature and weather patterns, we didn't have agriculture. And we could lose our agricultural base. We're going to have more and more floods and droughts and, you know, incredible fires, these wildfires that we're reading about, and then, you know, plastics pollution, chemical pollution, nutrient pollution, overfishing, invasive species, bottom trawling, seafloor mining, deep sea drilling, destruction of estuaries and wetlands, loss of coral reefs and, you know, sea ice habitat. And, you know, one we're hearing more about lately is the melting of permafrost, which could be a feedback loop like that I faced in Deep Rover. It's called the permafrost bomb. And it just becomes a positive feedback explosion almost. So it's incredible that we are actually managing to destroy and decimate the ocean before we even know what's in it. Usually our pattern has been to explore and then exploit, but we've managed to exploit the ocean before we explored it.
How much of our oceans have we actually explored and documented?
Well, I'd forgotten that TED talk you did at the beginning where I said 5%. That was the number that was in all the literature, but actually that's wrong. That is based on remote sensing, where you've got side scan sonar operated from ships at the surface. That number is actually increased now. It's now beginning to approach 30% that we've mapped, but that's not explored. Actually, you know, going and visiting the bottom of the ocean, we're talking about 0.05%. And wow. That's just the bottom of the ocean. That's not the huge, huge volume of water above it. So we've barely, barely begun to explore the ocean.
I want to circle back to your list there with plastic. And you highlighted the statistic that by the year 2050, the ocean will contain more plastic by weight than fish. In your explorations, what have you seen with plastic?
Yeah, it's alarming when you're on the bottom of the ocean and you come across plastic, which of course is a little surprising, but it gets weighted down with organisms that attach to it or other debris. And so you see plastic on the bottom of the ocean. But probably even more concerning are the microplastics that are getting into the food web and having impacts that we don't completely understand yet.
Humans are increasingly looking at mining the ocean floor for metals. How could this affect the life in the ocean?
Yeah, that's really scary. There's so much that's already happening in the ocean that's out of sight and out of mind, and mining would be similar to what's happened with bottom trawling. Bottom trawls are these nets that gets dragged across the bottom. They've got weights on and they cause the fish or the shrimp to jump up into the net. But they take these gorgeous undersea gardens that have taken thousands of years to evolve and sustain enormous amounts of life and turn it into rubble for one haul of shrimp. And they're going to do the same thing with deep sea mining. It's going to be hugely destructive and possibly release all kinds of toxins into the environment. So, you know, we need to have people much, much more aware of our ocean planet, that you live on an ocean planet is not just a trivia fact. It is what makes life possible on this, the only rock in the universe that we know that can sustain life. And we can't allow the machinery of life to be destroyed while we just sit idly by.
Very quickly here, Keith called with a follow-up question. What are they mining for on the ocean floor?
There are a lot of the metals that are, and this is ironic, of course, is that are used in a lot of our technology batteries, you know, more advanced batteries. So there's a lot of heavy metals that are needed for these manufacturing processes. Once again, you know, it's not realizing that we live in a closed system. When we mine anything, we're not putting it back ever. And it's incredibly short-sighted. We have to be able to think of manufacturing from cradle to grave and work the way nature does to return things to the ecosystem.
Edie, thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Edie Witter is co-founder and CEO of the Ocean Research and Conservation Association, author of the new book, Below the Edge of Darkness, a memoir exploring light and life in the deep sea. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.